You've stepped into The Last Video Store, a beautiful, mythical place with every single film aligning its many, many shelves. I am the clerk of The Last Video Store, and my name is Alexi Toliopoulos, and it is my honor to serve the people of this fine town, Batuta, with their cultural and filmic and cinematic needs. Joining me on the show today is a Batuta local, a bit of a local celebrity, a bit of a local character. It is Clancy Overall, the editor of the famed newspaper, the Batuta Advocate. And him stopping by means a lot to me. It feels like I'm being finally welcomed into this town and becoming part of the fabric. We're going to pick out some of his favorite movies, and I'm going to bestow upon him a bespoke recommendation based on his choices. Where will we go? Well, we're about to find out. Let's hit play. Welcome to the store, my friends.
I've heard about you.
Well, yeah, we've met before.
Yes, we have. I've heard about what you've been doing down here at the Last Video Store. Mm-hmm. Of course, could only be in our beautiful town of Batuta.
A cultural hub for you guys, I understand.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we obviously, as a newspaper man, in the world of print journalism still to this day, I guess we're kindred spirits.
Absolutely. We're both in forms of physical media. You love to make those page turners every day, and I love to see those discs going into the hands of the local community.
Well, just the concept of paper and disc also, you know, suggests that we are both of a bygone era.
Oh.
But not in this town.
Not in this town. We are still the current culture.
Yes.
We're what's happening, baby.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think, you know, and discs and paper go together. After all, the sleeve that goes inside the disc is made of paper itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, we are getting into the weeds a little bit. but yeah, I guess that's your game.
That's my game.
You know, my game is the news.
And I say game, recognize game. Right game, now, we're two games recognizing each other's
two
games.
Games recognize game.
Yeah.
And it's great to have another Greek in the town. I'm not Greek myself, but my mate is, who runs Samios Grocers.
Of course. Uncle Samios, we call him. Theo Samios. Yeah, it's beautiful that I go in. That's where I buy my vine leaves
from. I'm sure he's heard about you.
Oh, we're a small community here, the Greeks of Batuta, but we all get along just so passionately. Mm. You'll be walking around the Greek neighborhoods, the Greek quarter here, and you'll hear smashing plates, and you go, my God, these people must be fighting. No, no, no. There are weddings happening in our community every single afternoon.
I love the flight path district. We go down there a bit, you know, because the flight path district in Batuta is one of those places similar to any other flight path district in any other major metropolis around Australia, in that the Greeks and the Vietnamese live alongside each other and have done for generations, and do not acknowledge each other's existence.
No, no, no. We just cohabitate.
Yes.
Much like the Naboo and the Gungans in Star Wars.
Yes.
You know, we live in the same planet, we share the same space, but two different cultures
that coexist, cohabitate. Comes down to shop fronts.
Mm-hmm. And we've always said that.
Find me next to the
Souvlaki.
Souvlaki.
And one day some maverick is going to merge the two.
Well, one day the kids are going to hook up. That's what's going to happen. That's the only way it can happen.
That's it.
Romeo and Juliet style.
Which is a,
you know, good movie.
But, you know, I'm very grateful to be here in this town. I'm very grateful to be here.
We love having you.
It's been my dream to come back behind the counter. Yeah. It was where I got my career started in film distribution. Was as a teenager working behind the counter in a lovely little art house video store in Sydney, and it's actually been my dream to get back to that forever. Honestly, if video stores were still everywhere, I would 100% have been working at one non-stop for my whole life.
If the medium hadn't changed. So do you think by virtue of the medium changing, you had to then find another job in this space?
I probably did. I was like, fuck, I better become a comedian. Become a comedian, better become a film critic so I can watch movies elsewhere.
Personal question.
Of course.
In this era, this golden era of yours, which was obviously at the back end of the golden era of video stores, yeah. But you managed to catch a little bit of it.
I caught that last little whiff.
Were you partial to a little bit of the...
The reefer?
The riverina rolling, yeah. As we call it?
Well, I would tell this, I'll be honest. I'm on the record here. I guess it's past statute of limitations. I used to...
Blaze that shit up every day.
Yeah, I used to smoke a joint on my way over to the video store. Because
that's synonymous with video store clerks, is cannabis.
That's it, because it was slacker lifestyle. So I would get off, I'd roll one up, I'd walk to the bus having it as a chuff. Then I'd kind of relax it on the bus. Then I'd walk back to the video store from the bus stop and I'd be like, okay, now I'm in the perfect zone to
watch
just
movies all day.
Put movies on a screen all day. I'd be always watching, we had these great sets and they're like prime physical media for guys like you and I.
Yeah.
But it was these director's collections of music videos. Right. So it'd be like Jonathan Glazer, Michel Gondry, Spike Jonze.
Yep.
Like they would have these big sets and you would just put them on and you watch them all day long. And it would be the best thing to put on all day.
Yeah.
You're actually a member that predates my existence in this store. So there's no need to sign you up, Clancy. You've already got a system here. I'm checking here. You've got a few late fees, though.
Yes.
My gosh, okay.
Yeah, I used to get away with murder with the last mob.
Oh, gosh, okay. It looks like you owe us $657.50.
Again?
$657.50 in late fees.
Well, you know, the thing was with the last bloke, he just kind of let that roll on, and we'd kind
of... quite the tab.
Yeah, we'd talk at Christmas time, and it's not Christmas time, so you...
Well, I'll come back to you around December.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's just kick the can down the road, as I like to say.
Interesting. I won't go too far into your records here, but, you know, you've got Lahane. You still got it out, it says.
Yeah. Oh, no. I gave that back. I'm sure of it.
Okay, well, I'll check the shelves later. All right.
Great flick, Lahane.
Great flick. It looks like you got a lot of crime classics in here, but, you know, we've got a new member combo because you've come back into the store. I've taken over. I'm going to give you access to the new member rental combo one more time.
Right.
One new release, two weeklies, plus a staff pick recommendation from me unto you based on your taste as evidenced in your selection.
Okay, all right.
Head on out and pick up those flicks.
New release.
Well, there we go, Mr. Toliopoulos.
What a beautiful stack of movies. Mm-hmm. Your new release is peeking out at me straight away, and this is, I would say, one of my favorite movies in the last few years as well. Dare you say what it is?
The Quiet Girl.
Drama.
I can't tell you how they say it in Irish, but yeah, it's called The Quiet Girl. 2022 it came out.
I believe so.
Yeah.
When did you first come across this movie?
I think I must have read somewhere that it was an award winner or there was something somewhere. And I've obviously if you've read the Batuta Advocate, you'd know our newspaper's constant references to the Emerald Isle. We've been there. We have a close relationship with a similar newspaper over there called the Waterford Whispers. They're great fun, and we go and catch up with them from time to time, you know, similar format, and I guess similar humour and similar kind of characters we find in the Irish.
So you find a kinship with the Irish
There's
people.
A kinship there. A lot of Australians will say that. And
a lot of Australians will say they are Irish.
Yeah, which is not true. Especially the ones that say that they're Irish Catholic, Irish Catholic convict stock. Very rarely the case because, you know, there were Irish in the First Fleet and the Second Fleet, but not many. Mm. Not as many as people would suggest when they say that that's their ancestry. I feel like it's a real shock for Australians in Ireland because they think they're going to be met with, you know, a very similar...
being brought in.
Like there's obviously the humour and the, you know, and the interests and we were all raised on the same stuff, a little bit of Britain and a little bit of America.
Little Britain.
Yeah, no, yeah, Little Britain. But
computer says no.
There we go, that kind of computer.
That kind of stuff. We love that kind of humour.
The Irish had the similar influences growing up. They had The Simpsons, but, you know, they also would have got In-Betweeners, Mr. In-Betweeners and James Bond and those kind of things. But it is a rude shock when you go there and you realise that they're not, you know, larrikins. They're a bit more dry.
Mm.
And you learn their way pretty quick. They're very proud people and there's a big, you know, sense of, and I guess it comes from their history of, like, you know, there's a class solidarity thing. That they're very good at dissecting class, except for maybe Alan Joyce from Qantas. He seems to have lost those skills. But
he's ascended to new heights.
He's ascended to new heights. Whereas the South Africans, you know, great storytellers, you know, great. We have some sort of a hemispheric relationship with them, but you would never put them in charge of telling a story of, you know, Angela's ashes, right?
No, can't imagine it. No. I think,
and probably the British either. You wouldn't expect them to do that. Mm. A lot of people can't really interrogate, you know, rich dad, poor dad, like the Irish, and do it in a way that makes people feel comfortable and kind of maybe have a laugh.
And I think have a laugh, but also they're very emotional films. I think these, like, I think that a lot of Irish art is, like, expressed, like, through that emotionality of them. And A Quiet Girl, use the word dry, I would say this is the opposite.
Yeah,
I was sobbing wet watching this movie. Because this is one of those ones that absolutely accessed my heart on, like, such a deep level.
Yeah.
It's basically a film, and it's like a class story as well, to a degree. It's about a girl who grows up in a family with lots of siblings. There's a new sibling on the way, but she's quiet. She's kind of the dark horse of her family. Yeah. And she gets sent off to live with aunt and uncle or a cousin for basically the summer.
They've got a little bit more scratch. They've got a little, you know, they've got furniture and shit like that.
Yeah.
They're like fireplace in the house.
They've got something and they don't have a child in their life. Yeah. So they have room for this girl to be part of their family. Yeah. And oh my God, like, I actually am a bit lost for words when I kind of talk about this movie, because I think it is so, just so wonderful and so deeply moving to me. And it's just one of those great films about childhood that understands and captures perspective really well, because you see the whole world through the eyes of this girl, and it's all in the Irish language. So it's very immersive in just going, like, understanding who this person is, how they see the world, because you just get glimpses of an adult life.
Yeah. And it's I actually find it unlike anything that I've ever seen come out of Ireland or, you know, or that part of the world. Mm. It's very much a foreign film, not just because of the language, just because of the kind of mannerisms and the relationships that you see on screen. The stoicism is so authentic, I feel, but it's not something I've ever seen and could relate to. But, you know, that part of the world in what, mid-80s, 1980s in Waterford, County Waterford, so down the bottom of Ireland, where it would have been fairly remote and fairly, you know, hadn't been globalized in a sense, and the poverty. Like, to think that was happening, you know,
people were getting sent off to, like, live with relatives and stuff are only, like, a little bit more well off than them. It feels like such a, like, it doesn't feel from that era. It feels like something from, like, the 1940s. And just, it kind of captures, like, that, this kind of warm sorrowfulness or this warm melancholy that does feel very Irish.
Yeah.
Just think it's so beautiful. I saw this at Melbourne International Film Festival. I sat next to a colleague. We were not very close or anything. A friend of mine now, Jared Richards, another film critic. And by the end of the movie, we just looked at each other just completely wet-faced because we were just crying.
No chance,
and probably
right?
since then we became friends because of, like, sharing this, like, really Honorable beautiful moment. Experience with each other.
Yeah.
It's from writer-director Colm Bayard, and it stars Catherine Clinch, this 9-year-old girl.
Yeah.
I think both of these suggest, like, hopefully huge careers for both of these people.
Yeah, I mean, but maybe not. Like, it almost feels like one of those one-and-done films where everyone involved made that movie. Australia's big on that. You know what I mean? We have so many people that have done that thing, and they're probably not going to capitalize on that because they don't feel they need to, or, you know.
They were able to share their story.
Yeah, it's done. It. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's one opus that you do, and that's what it felt like. The fact that they've found an entire cast that can speak Irish like that, you know, obviously, I dare say there was a lot of real extras, you know what I mean? I don't know what the word is.
Like, it would be non-actors is kind of what we call them. Like, where it is people that are cast that have not been performing before. Mm. And so, you know, they're accessing something new. And I think Australian cinema does that a lot.
Yeah.
And I think this feels like that. I'm actually not sure if that's the case, but it might be. I would guess so.
No, it was a very moving film. And as you said, with the concept of seeing it through a little girl's eyes, it's funny, the little moments which look on screen like, you know, transitional scenes are actually such big scenes, you know what I mean? There's one where, you know, the girl's walking with the neighbor down the street and you know, some information is revealed to her about her aunt,
mm.
Which doesn't feel like much as an adult, you know, just it's just a gossipy neighbor, but it's obviously rocks this girl.
It's like that glance that just gets captured by them. It's yeah. like glance to some information.
Yeah, no, it was. I found it.
Did you cry?
Yeah, probably. It's the thing is, I think I would have definitely. That's why it's probably stood out to me because it's just so raw. I don't know when we've like what other kind of films, particularly involving children, that can be so authentic but also so adult. I don't know. Like I can't think of any other examples.
The one that comes to mind for me is I think another movie that I put onto you after you told me you love this film, Australian film by Gillian Armstrong, yeah. High Tide.
High Tide.
Which I think has, but that's a dual film where it's a older mother protagonist by Judy Davis and then a young Claudia Carvin as like her teenage daughter that they reconnect. But I think I don't think there's very many films like this that capture childhood in a way that you really have that resonance of going, oh, that is what it felt like when I was a kid.
Yeah.
A feeling that you've not thought about for like your entire adult life.
Maybe The Kite Runner, that Afghan film. Oh, yeah. You know, that's the closest thing because they deal with, I mean, obviously there's different things happening in Afghanistan in the 80s, but they you know, they kind of have these whimsical moments that are obviously deeply traumatic to children that the viewer, an audience can tell that's a deeply traumatic moment, but it's just kind of another scene, you know what I mean? Angela's Ash is another one that comes to mind when we're talking about poverty and like the what the child takes with them.
Yeah, probably Goonies.
Goonies is another great Goonies. One. If we're talking about this is our realm of children-centric films.
Goonies, BMX Bandits.
The Client with Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, and, actually Stand By Me would be another one that I would genuinely put in there where it's like catching that childhood's perspective of just like,
finding a dead body.
That's it. We all want to find that body. We all want to go on a little adventure.
Yeah.
But this is such a beautiful pick, Clancy. I think you've done a wonderful service bringing this to the attention of the masses on the podcast today.
Yeah, I would recommend this to anyone.
Oh, yeah. Hold it up for them one more time, babe. Hold that up.
Where are we going?
The Quiet Girl. Put it in every frame.
Put it in every frame.
Put it in every frame. One of the great pictures, The Quiet Girl. An emotional choice, a choice from the heart. Something that I did not expect from you today. I did not expect you to show such vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I applaud it.
No, but, you know, it's think of the films in history that everyone, doesn't even matter who it is. Like, doesn't matter if it's, like, the most burliest bloke you know. They cried watching it.
Oh,
think, well, what are those films? There's I Am Sam's probably one that got most people. Like,
the trailer. Know? The trailer gets a lot of people for I Am Sam, I'd say.
Yeah.
For Big Fellas, I tell you what, in my studies in this area, Rocky.
Rocky.
Because Rocky is total, like, it's emotional filmmaking. And Sly is the master of
He's a manipulator,
emotional.
Sly, yeah.
Yeah, he's a master of emotional manipulation.
Yeah, yeah.
I call it technique. Yeah. Use a lot of technique to help people feel their emotions. And I think those are the films that men connect to the most. He
manipulates people into feeling shit.
And the other big one, Deer Hunter. Deer Hunter. We've got that somewhere in our stacks here, the Deer Hunter.
Yeah, but no, there's ones that, you know, just like universally that aren't necessarily macho that'll get anyone.
Okay.
Like, I'm trying to think of
Steel Magnolias.
Steel Magnolias. Mm-hmm. Dolly, bless her.
Oh, yeah, bless her. Cotton socks.
I mean, it actually seems to be happening more and more now. What's that one that came out the other day that just
Argyle.
Yeah. Everyone just
Matthew Vaughn's Argyle,
What's that? The Fall one. What's that one that everyone's watching that I just don't know if I found an afternoon to sit down and watch it? Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh, Anatomy of a Fall. I don't know if that's a real... It's got moments. Yeah, yeah. I did tear up. But, you know, I'm an emotional guy. I'm on the verge of tears every second.
Yeah, yeah.
Every second of
the
day.
Well, you're cosmopolitan.
Exactly.
Kind of.
Cosmopolitan, Mediterranean. You know, we're passionate people. In touch with your emotions, course, those things happen to me, you know? And hopefully I'm spreading some of that charm to Batuta as well.
Yeah, you've revolutionized the way we see cinema. And that's why we're so happy to share Batuta Video with the world here.
Yeah. Let an insight into this beautiful cavern full of movies.
Look at
that
all
we've
this
got.
Shit on the shelves behind me.
Oh, we've got all this beautiful shit. The Collectors were the only movie I can recognize on the shelf behind me somewhere. Good. I've never seen it, but I've seen the cover. All right.
Oh, can't go past Alexi Toliopoulos' favorite, but
we'll let him
do a full episode on
that. That'll be a full episode. We'll get each cast member on. They're sitting on the other side of us going, God, so what? When you were doing that, well, that was awesome. That was really cool, guys. And I cried when I saw that.
I'm still
that
trying to think of those films that, you know, maybe that's one thing you can get your listeners to message in. What are the films that universally make people cry? Because You said Rocky, trying to appeal to me. As,
no,
you know,
but I believe it. Rocky is an emotional movie for men.
Then you said Deer Hunter, which I felt like I was that kind was of maybe
more. That was more. It's like, hey, big belly guy, probably Deer Hunter.
Sport and war, right? Yeah. That'll make you cry.
Those are the two things. If, as long as the fellas are getting pummeled down, that's what happens. The boys start to cry out. Brian Song, another sports movie?
Philadelphia. Oh, Philadelphia course, will make anyone cry.
Of course. And even that is the most hardline conservative drink.
There's those kind of
Life
ones.
Is beautiful.
Life is beautiful.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Is that the cupboard?
That's Nazis? The that you're talking about the Indian in the cupboard?
No, I'm talking about where they hide from the Nazis. Yeah.
That's it. Roberto Benigni. Best actor. Roberto Benigni. Yeah. Shall we move on to your weekly choices, my
please.
Friends?
Sorry, we've waffled about, you know, vulnerability for long enough.
That's it. You know, the boys have to get in touch with their feelings every now and then, you know?
Yeah, well, I can say the other two, it's a bit of a gear change here.
Yeah, we're switching it up.
Weekly.
I would say you've come in here with a rather eclectic batch of three movies. Where do you want to head to next with your next pick?
Well, what have you got there?
Well, this one you've picked up from the crime film section. Mm-hmm. One of our most abundant and popular aisles here at Batuta the Video. It is, oh gosh, it's a, you know, it's a mid-career classic from one of the all-times, the goats of cinema, if you will, Mr. Martin Scorsese. It is Casino.
Mm.
Crime.
His second collaboration with true crime writer and screenwriter Nicholas Pileggi.
Yeah.
Returning to familiar genre as they did earlier with Goodfellas, like a really big film for both of them. Yeah. They come back with Casino doing it all over.
5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unsung.
I agree with you, yes.
I think for many reasons, like it could have been the worst plot of all time. But I don't believe that. I think it's a very, very real story.
Mm-hmm.
And the themes of the, you know, obviously it's Scorsese, so there's some element of a fall from grace there, but in the plot. But just the fact, like, they could have had no storyline. Like, one scene could have not connected to the other, and I still would have put it in my top five just because of what they made.
Mm.
The fact that 80% of this film would have at least 300 to 400 extras on screen at any time, just monstrous. Like,
they're all wearing pastels, cranking those machines.
The costuming
playing
is
those
sensational.
Slots.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I think this is a really strong movie from Scorsese, and I agree, unsung. Because, you know, Goodfellas is such a monumental film and such a hit that strikes across the board in every way.
Yeah.
And he's reteaming with Joe Pesci, reteaming with Robert De Niro, bringing Sharon Stone in as well. So now it's also, like, because Goodfellas is such like a lightning rod film that has this really unique style.
Yeah.
It uses style to like almost music video techniques and like really fast cutting, jump cutting, match cutting, lots of like interesting editing techniques from Thelma Schoonmaker and Martin Scorsese. But it uses that style to create this authenticity, this feeling of like almost a romantic authenticity of that world. And then it uses that same style to have this frantic crash.
Yeah.
And then from there, that brutal hangover that the film ends on, where you almost get that like high, that sugar high at the start, and it just keeps getting better. And then it gets worse and worse until you're like, oh, I'm over it. He employs that similar kind of style, but he uses it in Casino to create like this maximalist operatic tone rather than true authenticity or romanticized authenticity. And it's a tone that he strikes so precisely. And I don't think we've seen it ever before in any other film, let alone his work and since, even though it's utilizing a lot of the same techniques.
I also think that he's been given a different environment to play in here. Like Goodfellas, it's obviously going to be compared to because you've got Pesci in both films playing the charismatic psychopath, right? Which is what he does, and which is why he became a household name in the 80s and 90s. He plays the same character in Home Alone. You know what I mean? And
different wigs and nuances.
Different wigs and nuances. You know, the wet bandits were a different kind of crime. But you know, the difference between Goodfellas and this is set in the desert. It's set in, you know, these monstrous casinos between LA and Vegas. And this, you know, and Goodfellas is Scorsese playing in tenements, you know what I mean?
And you know, the Little Italy.
Little Italy and little bars and that kind of stuff, where this is just to scale, to a scale that I don't think you'd be allowed to ever again.
Because it's like million dollar movie, which is for like 3 hour crime epic that is kind of experimenting and like a proper hard R. Like the violence is brutal in this movie.
And the swearing. Like I think it was the record holder for many years of F words.
You can say it.
Fuck words.
Maybe you can't.
What I really love about it is the way Vegas is presented in the early days of Vegas. Like Vegas is still a weekly part of our life in the Western world. You know, the NFL's hosted there. Every boxing match is hosted there. You know, U2's touring there. We know what's happening in Vegas.
Guy Fieri has a restaurant there.
Yeah, Guy Fieri. Jermaine Dupri's just announced a residency.
Of course. Al Kiley.
Al Kiley, Human Nature, did many years there. But it is what it is now. But then it was literally, and that's how it's described by Ace Rothstein, the protagonist, I guess.
Yep.
De Niro's character it was like a car wash for men like him. It was just, it relieved them of their sins. He was a handicapper, a sporting gambler, match fixer, like, you know, a slime ball everywhere else in America. But in Vegas, he was actually high society.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows this Vegas that I've never actually been to Las Vegas, but I don't think I ever want to go because of this romantic kind of 60s, 70s, 80s that they present where, you know, the mafia is effectively in charge of everything. And I actually think that even the politics of the place would have definitely changed by now, because back then you've got this hierarchy where you've got the scumbags on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the street criminals.
Mm-hmm.
You've got
your sleaze criminals, James Woods, Lester Diamond in the movie.
Lester, one of the most sleazy characters in the world.
I think he should have been Oscar nominated. Yeah. I'm saying that I was a James Woods fan. Yes, he's gone completely off the wackadoo end
now. I think he always was.
But he is phenomenal in this movie. There's never been a greater slime ball actor. This side of like Tom Sizemore.
It's also a great, I mean, it's only Scorsese would boldly do this character and this dynamic where the independent, strong, street hustling, you know, femme fatale is dependent on a slime ball. Like, it's kind of a trope, but it's not really done. Mm. And I think they did it very well where it's, you know, Sharon Stone, even those two actors. Imagine the idea of her bowing to him.
I know.
And they did it very well.
And I would say Sharon Stone in this film is maybe the...
She was the only nomination.
Only nomination. I would say it's maybe the best performance like ever in a Scorsese film. Like in the same ballpark as freaking Raging Bull or Taxi Driver, this performance is just... It's so unique. It's so unique in the crime genre, so unique in any genre. And it's just, you just don't see anything like it, especially just finding the perfect actor to line up with the perfect character, to just completely embody the spirit of the film. And
I don't think anyone would have thought that at the time, though, in how her career was going. You know, she's coming off the legs crossing.
Yeah,
you
know, Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct. She had been typecast, and she was I don't know who the modern day equivalent would be, but she was, you know, kind of a bit of a Marilyn Monroe Barbie.
Yeah,
and she just did this film, a 3 hour film of her basically abusing organized criminals and making them fear her.
And she works so well with Dark Material, Sharon Stone, but I think, and she's funny, like she's kind of got everything.
Yeah.
And I think there's this line in the film that I believe it's a quote from the Robert De Niro character in the narration.
Yeah.
The cardinal rule is to keep them playing and to keep them coming back. Yeah. The longer they play, the more they lose, and in the end, we get it all. And I think that is the thesis for the film.
Yeah.
Life is a casino for these players.
Yeah.
They keep playing, and these people get so much wealth into their lives, like beyond any kind of belief. They have this lavish lifestyle. Yeah. De Niro's outfits are the most beautiful suits cinema has ever seen. Yeah. And each freaking scene, he's got a new suit on that is something that you can't even conjure up in your head.
No. You wouldn't be able to find it anywhere. But what I also find, though, there is... you know, the music does stop. Mm-hmm. It shows in that. I don't know if it's the case anymore in Vegas, but the fact is there's these Mormons and these cowboys that actually run this town.
That LQ Jones guy coming in.
They put their boots on the table. They're completely fine with you to do what you do in the desert, but there are rules and they have to be looked after. And if you get too big for your boots, if you go Icarus on them, it's all over.
It's all over.
It doesn't matter if you're from the scariest mafia family in America, they have senators and they have congressmen and they will, you know, I do like that there's in every element of this excess of this Vegas, there's something that can, you know, stop you. Whether it's you can get brutally murdered, get your head put in a vice, one of the most violent deaths I've actually seen.
I've never forgotten it.
Yeah.
I saw this movie for the first time.
The hammer on the hand for the card counters.
Oh my gosh.
But then you've got also when he's talking about actually as a handicapper, he's the most genius handicapper. He's the most, you know, talented. He's Ace Rothstein.
Yeah, shout to Lefty Rosenthal, the real guy.
Based on Lefty Rosenthal.
Shouts to Lefty.
Like this just quiet Jewish guy from Chicago who was so good with his money that he became, you know, an honorary Italian, and the mafia sent him to Vegas. But for him to even say that he can get bested by gamblers, like not by cheats, by actual, and you know, by my favorite is KK Ichikawa, the Japanese businessman, and he goes, he plays fast and he plays big and he has the cash and the credit to turn out your lights, and he goes, you know. He can shut down casinos. And Kerry Packer had a reputation for doing that too. He would make people stressed when he would go into these casinos because he would, if he was on a heater, it could fuck them up for their quarter, and it actually could. And people have sent them broke. And the Japanese character, the whale, Ichikawa, is a great. Is just a great when he's showing the different archetypes within a casino in that era when it's still run by people.
Yeah.
How he still steals the towels. He steals the towels and the soap. And then, you know, so he, not only does he leave with $2 million of the casino's money in 1978, which is could fuck them up, he steals the towels and the soap. He's just a cheapskate millionaire, flies in on a private jet from Japan, and they go, we got him back though.
That's it. They go, he has the power to turn the jet back around to bring him back in, and Ace gets all the money back off him again.
So he tells, pays the pilot to tell you know, the Japanese whale.
Yeah. We can't leave today.
Well, the plane's on the fritz. How embarrassing. We'll comp you a room.
Yeah.
Put him back on the floor.
Yeah.
And then he starts burning into his own money. He goes through the $2 million and goes into his own money. But, you know, to think that you know, someone like KK Ichikawa could have ended this movie halfway through. It's so mortal, every element of it. Even though it's a fantasy land, it feels like this thing is it's amazing. I don't know how many years over this is set, maybe a decade.
Yeah, a decade.
The actual marriage and the story of Casino. It could have ended at any moment, especially when you're dealing with characters like Pesci's who just...
I think that's why it's one of the great gambling movies, even though you're not always seeing like the gambling. Like the stakes are never on a card game or anything, but life is a gamble for these people. Mm. They get rich, and then by the end, they gamble it until they have freaking nothing left.
And I think as a Queenslander, it appeals as well. And this is just in the sense of that glitz and the glamour and the white shoes. And that's very much how Queensland's identity was forged. With Japanese investment too. Like it was a similar kind of scene. We had the casinos that people from Asia would come to visit. And we like the name Bruce Vegas doesn't come from... People think Bruce Vegas comes from this idea of... Queensland being fun and you know a marketing campaign. It actually comes from the Southern Cops in New South Wales and Melbourne referring to the crime of Brisbane, which was
really
burying people in holes, illegal casinos, neon lights, so there's a little bit of that flair that you kind of. I don't think it's an American thing. It's you see that in all those different parts of the world where you have kind of red light districts and you have that look. Vegas. And I guess the Gold Coast has tried to do this in some way, is try to legitimize that look and make it you know mainstream and tourist friendly. But Vegas has been the best to do it, and you know, and then also that era of America when you're dealing with Vegas, you're dealing with Sinatra-esque characters, and that's always something that people want to revisit. And that's the film. This film's 3 hours, so you get so much of that. It's like, you know, that Lana Del Rey Psycho Americana kind of. You know, we're talking senators, we're talking corrupt racing officials. We're talking...
It's the one place where they all sit on top of each other.
Yeah.
And the power splits between them all. God, it's a great pick. I absolutely love Casino. You've got one more weekly for us here.
Yep.
And I saw you wandering around the comedy section picking this one out. Another curveball for us here.
Yeah. I guess there's a bit of a gear change between all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we started with The Quiet Girl because just more of a feminine kind of gentle touch because these other two are pretty... You know,
pretty masculine picks.
Pretty louty.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we've got maybe is this a comedy section or is this a sports movie? I think it might be one of the great sports movies.
It is. It's a sports movie. Here. I was thinking that actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cracker Jack.
Comedy.
Cracker Jack, Australian film from 2002. To me, this is the ideal bludgery Australian larrikin comedy of the 21st century so far. And I think the Lawn Bowls Club setting for it is just such a distinctively Australian place to set a sports comedy. Yeah. Tell us about Cracker Jack.
I think Cracker Jack is another one that's unsung because when we look back to that era when Australian comedy was popping, you know, there's always been... an interesting thing in Australia where we have this noir, this gothic even, with our crime. Right?
I call them true blue dunnets, if
you will. Yeah, the true blue tinge of our films, right? That's our drama and our crime. And then we have a couple moments of comedy. And I don't think Cracker Jack gets looked at in this moment because people would obviously look at the castle.
Yes, I think it's on the tail end of this kind of burst cycle Australia had with, we had like a big burst of independent films, independent films in Australia in the 90s.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes into the 2000s a little bit. And in that, there's a little cycle of comedies like Muir's Wedding, The Castle, that become like foundational to the Australian sense of humour.
Yeah.
Cracker Jack, I think, is just on the tail end, but is maybe just as important, maybe if not more, because it's such an overt comedy. It's like straight and straight a comedy. Like Muir's Wedding, it's a comedy, but it's got the saddest plot of all time.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I love that funny comedy about a woman whose mother kills herself because she's sad and her husband treated her like crap the whole life.
Yeah.
But this is, it's warm, it's got emotional beats, but it's just a flat out, like really funny, great Australian comedy.
Yeah, it's. I think it's also the last of the Australian comedies before we start entering like a formulaic kind of style.
That and Kenny, kind of like the last two greats.
Yeah, Jacobson could have fucked Kenny so badly. Like if Kenny was in any way, you know, had a sharp tongue, it wouldn't have worked. He had to be the kind of slow... Dunny guy, right?
Perfect. It's perfectly pitched, Kenny. And it never breaks the form of its mockumentary.
Yeah, right. The mockumentary also helped that. And that was just before that became Tide. That was before 10 seasons of The Office. That was before all that stuff. I think Cracker Jack's perfect because that character is perfect to be the smart ass. The layabout, stoner, telemarketer.
Yeah.
Mick Malloy, you know, I think he was the perfect person to play
He's perfect. Yeah. And it's the kind of thing because Mick Malloy's not a great actor.
No.
But to me, this is such a heroic story of casting where it's just like every aspect of his performance is so charming.
Yeah.
Like because it is just perfect casting.
Yeah. Well, I think also Mick Malloy at that time in his career would have done a bit of corporate speaking. So he had the beats. He knew the crowd. He knew applause breaks. And when you can get someone to do that on screen, it's, you know...
He nails it.
He knows when people are going to laugh. Mm-hmm. And the wisecracks, some of the, you know, some just the off comments, you could it's layered in a sense. I don't know if it was intentionally layered, but you go back, you know, I missed that, you know, 10 years ago when I watched this. You know, when he refers to the... Homebrew my ass, send that shit down to forensics. You know what I mean?
There's like that sing-song quality, like that melodious quality to his joke style telling in this, where he's like performative. Yeah. And it just, to me, it works so well and it feels so like just linked to the way comedy kept developing in this country.
And it was a great insight into like the middle class, you know what I mean? Like back then, the slacker could kind of get by in a nice joint in the city with a housemate smoking weed, working as a telemarketer with a few things on the side. And also the old codgers, right? So the old codgers in the bowls club that he's forced to become friends with through this turn of events, they are, when you think back to it, they would have been World War II. So that's like the silent generation. It's not the boomer thing that we know now.
Yep.
It's those old grandfatherly kind of characters.
Gen X versus the greatest generation.
Yeah, it's a, and that's a great, because he's the slacker. He's the Gen X slacker. And then you've got these people that have lived, you know, through depression and world wars. And, you know, he epitomizes the smart-ass youthfulness of that era. You know, the Beavis and Butthead, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's also so cool that he's supported by this wonderful, like, cast of these older actors.
Bill Hunter.
Bill Hunter, man. Yeah. Maybe Australia's greatest actor, Australia's greatest character actor, for sure. And for me, this alongside his more darker turning Square.
Yeah.
It's probably his last two great roles. Yeah. Like, maybe this is his last great, like, actual character that he gets to play.
Yeah. This was an interesting era where they had the money to kind of bankroll. I mean, I know that film was done on the cheap, considering what we see nowadays, but they got the money and they were able to lock in these kind of actors pretty early on. You know, John Clark was a great inclusion because we never really got to see him. I know he had a history of TV comedy in New Zealand, but we never got to see him really in character. And he played the villainous Pokey Baron perfectly. Yeah.
Great actor. Also in Death in Brunswick, another great movie. John Clark in it.
But this was the era when there were certain tax laws where you could invest in films, and Macquarie Bank had an arm for investing directly in films. They got rid of it in the end. And, you know, the reason they got rid of it in the end was because one of the reasons cited was there was too much of a reliance on comedy.
Which we have zero.
Which we have zero, you know what I mean? We have zero now. And I do believe they might have gotten a bit formulaic. You start getting some of these names and you get this plot and it's the underdog come good. Like, you can see how Australians fall into that trap. Especially when they're making movies for the sake of making movies.
Yeah.
But this one feels like, you know, in terms of the opus, right? We're talking about The Quiet Girl. This feels like Malloy's opus. He's still on, you go down to Melbourne, you still listen to him, you know, on radio every day. Same with Sydney. And he's still very much, you know, mid-career, I would say. But, you know, to think he got this in his early 30s, late 20s, and just got this one away, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you can't not admire him and the whole, like, cast of this film, like, that era of comedy making. Huge special notice to Judith Lucy in this film as well. Yeah. To me, top five all-time comedic performers. I just love Judith Lucy so much. And I'm going to put this right on the record now. Maybe number one or two dream guest all-time for this podcast.
Let's do the official shout out. Judith Lucy, they want you on here.
We want you, Judith. We want you so bad for this podcast.
You're a much more important guest than I would be. And he's made that clear. So please, Judith Lucy, come along.
Well, you know, we've had our first dream guest. We've got to put a new one out into the world.
I'm a tough act to follow. Come along, please.
But I just love this. I think, you know, great era for Australian comedy. We've got this, The Nugget. We've got, you know, Kenny. I just think that I wish we had more comedies. I often, like, lamentedly joke that Kenny was the last comedy made in Australia. Yeah. Now we've got some more happening, but I think we've got, like, world-class comedy when it comes to internet and, like, new media comedy, live comedy.
And see, that's a lot of people doing it off their own, you know.
That's
like,
it.
They're doing it on the smell of an oily rag. And I do think it would be interesting to see just, you know, even Kath and Kim, right? The great Kath and Kim was made on a drama budget.
Yeah.
They fucked up the whole thing at the ABC. And
iconic story.
Yeah. Well, So whatever happened, it ended up being in the ABC drama department. Yep. That's how it got over the line. People really don't want to invest in comedy in Australia. And I feel like this one should be one of the ones that they hold up to argue for that. Because you got Mick Malloy. He's obviously had such a pivotal part in this story. He wrote it with his brother or his cousin, I believe. Yep. And he was obviously there for every minute of it. And he got one away. You know what I mean? That's what we love to see, is someone getting one away. Like that that Australian lady who does the horror. And
Jennifer Kent?
Yeah, Nightingale.
Nightingale and the Babadook.
Yeah, I mean, Nightingale was obviously her passion project, but the one before that was the one that she You know, someone said somewhere along the lines, let's back her.
Yeah.
And it really did pay off.
Yeah. Mm. Well, let's hopefully people see, just go, we got to make more comedies. Because I think Crackerjack speaks to like a nation's identity to some degree of just being like, this is what our sense of humor is.
Yeah. World War II prices.
Okay. That's it. That's how much the weeklies cost here too. World War II prices on the shelves. Yes.
Staff pick.
Okay, we've come to it, the staff pick recommendation, your final pick for your combo.
Yeah, staff pick.
Staff pick, mate. It's been tough. I'll tell you this. I feel like you've purposely challenged me picking three completely different movies. And because, you know, we walk around the town together, you and I, we have many conversations. Yeah. I did come in anticipating we would have a crime spree here. I thought you were going to have three interesting crime films. You've got one crime film, one beautiful coming of age story, and one of the great Australian comedies. Mm. So I'm telling you right now, I'm not stumped, but I'm triangulating down to a pick. So we've got the three picks here. Casino, The Quiet Girl. Up the top here, we got Cracker Jack.
Yeah, they are a bit different, aren't
they? They are different. So I've got some, I'm still triangulating down to get to the perfect pick for you. What do you want to be the dominant flavor coming in here? Do you want that Australian kind of comedy?
You know, one thing you put me on a while ago, which has actually fucked me up. You put me on to Mezzarine.
Oh my God, great movie.
Put me on to Mezzarine. Yeah, it was a great French film about, you know, the great French bank robber, real person in 1960s France. And that has sent me Vincent Cassel, incredible actor, and the bouncing back and forth, you know, the historical element of it, which I obviously love about Casino. Like these are facts. And that sent me down a path of, you know, Algerian resistance and paramilitaries in France and the Day of the Jackal. And,
oh, yeah.
You know,
I'm telling you to watch Battle of Algiers and stuff like that.
See, I've got to watch Battle of Algiers, another one. I do like that foreign aspect. Okay. I like the foreign aspect, obviously, which you get with The Quiet Girl. You get to see a portal to a world you don't know. And it makes you realize there's so many more films on the shelves that you can see for all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like the historical fiction too.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, those are the dominant themes.
I got no historical fiction in my list.
Not
right now.
Historical fiction, but you know the historical aspect of Casino, of Mezzarine.
All right.
Is this making it harder for you to
maybe
triangulate?
Maybe it's making it harder. I'm going to chuck the historical aspect out. I'm triangulating down. Okay, dominant crime or comedy? What do you want more? What do you feel
crime.
More?
It's got to be crime, yeah.
All right, cool. Okay, we're going crime. Mm-hmm. Well, then I have come up with a selection for you. Mm-hmm. I've triangulated it down. There were a few options coursing around my head, a few Australian comedies, but now I've gone back to Europe for you.
Okay.
It's a European crime film, but it doesn't start as a crime film. The movie is the second film by Danish filmmaker Niklas Winding Refn, his follow-up to Pusher, a gangster classic. It is called Bleeder.
Bleeder.
Crime.
From
1999. Really?
It stars... basically, the whole cast of Pusher is back for Bleeder.
I've been recommended Pusher. I've never watched Pusher, so I am...
Pusher was the one that I originally had in my head for you. Yeah, but then when things started to change, when I saw your picks come in, it started changing to Bleeder. Yeah, because Bleeder also stars Kim Bodnar, Mads Mikkelsen, Zlatko Buric.
Yeah.
But Bleeder is a story that is quite different. It's a bit tonally more different. This is why I chose it, because I want to capture some of like that small world feeling that both The Quiet Girl has and definitely Cracker Jack has, where it's like this small little world. And Bleeder definitely has that. But then it kind of evolves to become a crime film.
Yeah.
And the place where it ends is so dark.
Yeah.
But it does start almost like Clerks.
Right.
Mads Mikkelsen works in a video store. And he plays the kind of...
This is your dream.
This is my dream. Yeah, this is the one that I had to track down. This is in the darkness of our shelves. I had to look in all the most hidden parts of
I imagine it's going to be very, very easy to watch.
Well, you know, you have a count to 1, 2, 3 and you might find it out there on the internet yourself. But it is...
Lucky you have a, you know,
Luckily, we've got everything, man. We've got everything here on the shelves, but he basically plays like the Nicholas Vinding Refn character.
Right.
And he's almost like this sad loner who is also just like he doesn't really know how to talk to women. Even though it's like Mads Mikkelsen, this is a really handsome guy.
Yeah.
But it kind of has multiple stories, multiple perspectives, much like Casino.
Yep.
And it's very clear on perspective, kind of like The Quiet Girl. But it starts out quite funny, like in this like world where it's these two men, Mads Mikkelsen's the loner, and then Bodnia plays a guy who's just on the cusp of fatherhood, but he's not ready for it yet.
Yeah.
And they watch movies together in like the back rooms of this video store. And it's the most beautiful video store you've ever seen. It's just like VHS tapes
not
everywhere.
Not as good as this one.
I'm going to say it's the most beautiful store I've ever seen. And it has overt Casino references.
Oh, really?
There is one of the earliest shots in this movie is a camera running around the whole video store, like close-ups on all the tapes, running around really fast to the same opening number, St. Matthew Passion by Johann Sebastian Bach, that Casino has like the opening titles to.
It's almost opera.
That opera, operatic sound. It's the same song. And they have a few more overt references to Casino throughout.
You're
would have been like the primary film at that time that cinephiles were into.
And I love that juxtaposition in Casino where you've got the neon and the kind of glamorized slime of Vegas with opera where they've actually made it look like, you know, something that could have been ancient. And I reckon I'd love to see that in a video store as well.
Yeah, I think you'll really dig this. Like it really begins in like a really kind of slacker comedy space, not unlike Cracker Jack.
Yeah.
But then it just keeps evolving. It's not even a tonal shift because it takes
like
time to get
like
there.
Sounds like you've triangulated this pretty well.
I think so. By the end, there's something that's so horrific that happens in this movie that earns the title Bleeder for you.
Okay.
Here we go. Really?
Well, as I said, it would have been 30, 40 times I've watched Casino and I've seen someone's head in a vice until their eye comes out. So I'll be able to stomach the Bleeder, I hope.
I don't know, man. There's something in this that's like, oh my fuck, that's horrible what they do. But it's an interesting film for Refn. It's right after he makes Pusher, which is his breakout film. Yep. Then he goes to America, makes Fear X with John Turturro. Huge flop. Then he has to come back to Denmark and make Pusher 2.
Right.
And he's had a very interesting career.
Has he made other American films?
Drive.
Drive. Why I was thinking of his name. With
Drive.
That's funny because when you watch Drive, you know it's a European guy making it.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's made a few more since then, but I would say Bleeder was a bit of a discovery for me.
Right.
I actually had to go hunting for a movie for you. So I watched three movies, two that I'd never seen before because like I have to get it down here. But Bleeder is the pick for you today.
Terrific. Thank you, Alexi.
Thank you for bringing me into this town.
Happy to have you.
And welcome me. Make me feel so welcome. Is there anything people should be looking out for from the Batuta Advocate at the moment?
No, just our weekly interviews. We've got some interesting big names coming up.
Ooh, you've got one of our customers is popping over there, Angela White.
Angela White, yeah. Had a good chat with Angela White. That was couple of weeks back now,
what do I smell? Is those beds burning?
Yes, that should be a good enough hint. We've got the beds are burning. One of our guests came in to tell us all about that.
Yeah, you can say his name,
Peter Garrett.
Yeah, it's huge. It's awesome.
It was a great chat.
Two parter,
I reckon. But yeah, that's the life and times. But kind of not making TV this year.
Mm-hmm.
That was last year with Batuta Presents, but.
But still check it out.
Yeah.
We've got a digital copy on the shelves here, Paramount Plus.
Yeah,
Paramount Plus section at the back.
You can get it on Prime. You can get it on Qantas or Jetstar in-air entertainment, on-flight entertainment.
God, only there were days where it was just the one big screen playing.
I know.
The Batuta Advocate presents.
Yeah, no, I think. I don't know if they'd do that in the middle aisle. That's more of a twister, you know? Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Clancy. Come back anytime.
Beautiful.
Take those and rack off, mate.
The last video store.
Okay.
My thank yous to the Batuta Advocate and Clancy for joining us on the show today and making us feel so freaking welcome into this town. And what a wonderful selection of films we had there. The Quiet Girl, an absolutely devastatingly beautiful and friendly and nice, kind Irish movie, is available for you to rent on VOD across most of those platforms where you usually rent stuff online. Then we have got Casino, which is on Amazon Prime and Paramount Plus, and you can buy a beautiful 4K copy if you want to watch it in physical media, which is what I recommend in this situation. Crackerjack, one of my favorite things, it's on Netflix and Stan. It's on both of them. I love it when that happens. And Bleeder by Nicholas Winding Refn. It's a little tougher to find, so you might need to go hunting out there on the internet for where you can find movies, or you can buy an imported UK or German copy of the film for over $50 or $60. I found one for $200, which I did not buy. I'm almost tempted to, though. And although it does not have English subtitles, but the version I found on the internet out there did have English subbies. So just go hunting, you'll find it. And I recommend you do. Actually, I don't know if I can say that legally, but enjoy it wherever you find it. Anyway, thank you for joining us on The Last Video Store. Until next time, please remember to be kind to each other and rewind the tapes that you borrow from our store. And I'm Alexi Toliopoulos. I'll say my name too.